Politics in this country is unusual right now. The economy, a little bit too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 4th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Look, I know it's hard not to be distracted by the political news of the day, coming as it does in never-ending waves. But be strong, would you, and hang in with us because, you know, it's only the global economy on the line, right? 5 days, 5 minutes of live radio in which to wrap it all up. Anna Swanson is with The New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is with Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Sudeep, let me first, I just want to hit you with the jobs report. 160-something thousand new jobs. The unemployment rate, the big headline there, down to 3.9%. What's not to love, yeah?
Yeah, it's pretty good numbers, at least on the surface. We still have the continued puzzle, though, of strong job growth and low unemployment, but disappointing wage growth.
Right.
We've come a long way from 9 years ago when the recession was ending and unemployment was around 10%. Who would have thought we'd end up with low unemployment, good job growth, and Donald Trump as president threatening trade wars? But that's the funny world we live in. So here we are.
Thanks for the segue, man, because Anna, the next question goes to you. And I'm going to read you something now. It came out of the White House today. And the quote is a statement on the United States trade delegation's visit to Beijing. Here you go. The delegation held frank discussions with Chinese officials on rebalancing the United States-China bilateral economic relationship. Frank discussions is code for things went terribly, right?
Well, it looked like just the very beginning of a long and potentially very rocky road. Now, at least, we do know what the U.S. side wants, and it's a lot. It doesn't look like a quick win. It looks like they want substantive changes. They ask for big things like cutting tariffs, China stopping subsidies to advance manufacturing, and a $200 billion reduction in the trade deficit, which is more than half of what it already is. So China analysts, I think, will think this is good, but it does mean there's a tough fight ahead because China has said they would not do some of these things. The thing I worry about is that for a lot of stock market analysts, their base case is a negotiated outcome,
right,
not tariffs going into effect. And that's looking harder, I think, for the administration to avoid.
So I'll get back to the deficit thing, the trade gap thing in a minute. But Sudeep, I want to ask you about something Peter Navarro said. And this is a quote. The discussions were held in Beijing. Decisions will be made in Washington, D.C. That does not sound very negotiation friendly.
Yeah, it's funny. The group of negotiators that went over, they have some disagreements among themselves. And I hope they had a chance to hug it out on the plane back. But it's not clear where the U.S. position is. It's not really clear where President Trump is. He is not the first president to be called the opposite of Teddy Roosevelt. You know, the idea that you speak loudly
right
and
now
carry a small stick, that you're not quite using that policy. And Trump has to figure out, like, what happens if you... if the American people keep seeing the bark without the bite. And so they're starting to learn to ignore this. Foreign leaders are starting to learn to ignore the bark. And so he's kind of in a bit of a pickle now because he needs the Chinese on all sorts of other things like North Korea. But he also has to deliver some promises to his voter base and others thinking about November 2018.
Anna, we should say here there are legitimate causes for concern about some Chinese economic practices, right? Forced technology transfers and intellectual property theft, and those are real. And the president has said and has been supported by many who say, listen, we really need to do this. But let me ask you about the thing that he always harps on, and that is the trade deficit and how he wants to get it down. Other than maybe the Chinese buying more things here, doesn't that sort of depend on American consumers not buying as much from China?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what the Chinese will be arguing, that the trade deficit is very linked to American saving or lack thereof.
Right, yeah.
And what are they going to do about it? I mean, they have offered to make purchases in order to reduce the trade deficit somewhat. The thing is, the U.S., some things they want to buy, the U.S. doesn't particularly want to sell them, including tied technology goods.
Right.
The Trump administration sees that as a national security risk right now. So how they would reduce it, $200 billion, I'm really not sure.
Yeah. Sudeep, quick last one to you, and that is, given the political chaos and the news coming in waves as it does, talk to me about downside economic risk. I mean, I think the markets and American companies have gotten what they expected out of the first Trump term, right? Taxes and regulatory relief, and now there's nothing else to get hung up on.
that's what they wanted. And now they're trying to prevent what they don't want, which is a big trade war and a lot of things to upset them in the late stages of an economic expansion. They're starting to feel like maybe they do have the beginnings of a predictable government for the world's largest economy. Right. And that's what their end goal is. But you never know what kind of shock could come in and end it all and make the good times suddenly look bad. And that's what they're worried about now.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Anna Swanson. She covers global trade for The New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, it was jobs, and then Apple and Warren Buffett. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to go a little bit deeper into this morning's jobs report because, I mean, come on, 3.9% unemployment is pretty remarkable. The lowest, as you've heard, in 18 years. The weird thing, though, is what's not happening with unemployment that low. Steady, sustained wage increases, as Sudeep mentioned, as companies get more desperate to find workers and realize they are going to have to pay more to get them. So we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, what is different between then, 18 years ago, and now?
Let's go back in time to September 2000. Bill Clinton's president, it's the tail end of the dot-com boom. Madonna's song Music is number one on the Billboard charts. Hey, Mr. DJ, put a record on, I wanna dance. And unemployment was at 3.9%. Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research remembers.
You saw pretty good real wage growth up and down the income ladder. So we're not talking about just higher paid workers, but people working at fast food restaurants, custodians.
Baker says wages were growing 2% a year adjusted for inflation. That's about double today's rate. He says labor unions were more powerful, pushing pay higher. Douglas Holtz Aiken headed George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisers starting in 2001. He says the rapid spread of computer technology helped employees to produce a lot more for every hour worked. Today, those tech changes have pretty much played out.
That's the missing link in the U.S. labor market. Better productivity growth, better pay.
University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson was on the Council of Economic Advisers under President Obama and says employers now have more leverage.
There are a bunch of big employers out there that have a lot of bargaining power. Most workers in the economy aren't able to credibly say, you know what, if you don't give me a raise, I'm going to leave.
All the economists I interviewed say in time, wages should rise more strongly as workers become harder to find. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If, in theory, employers ought to be getting a bit anxious about the state of the labor market, people looking for jobs ought to be feeling pretty good, right? Marketplace's Rima Kreis talked to some of those folks today.
Before she went out to celebrate yesterday, 20-year-old Erica Jackson called her mom to give her the good news. She got a job that pays $20 an hour.
My mom was like, $20 an hour? I have to move to Florida. She was really happy for me.
Jackson currently makes $10 an hour as a home health aide in Tampa. Her new job is at a call center.
I can't believe I got it because I've never worked in sales. This is new to me.
And she only applied a few days ago. Over in Houston, 29-year-old Caitlin Greenwood has also been having job luck. Big change from what she experienced after graduating from college into the recession.
By comparison, this feels luxurious in terms of how people are hiring.
Greenwood recently landed an advertising job. And 3 months into it, a recruiter lured her away to an even better job.
I'm maybe a rare breed that I love job hunting. I think it's fun.
It's fun when it works out.
The more I apply, the more discouraged I get.
Jeffrey, we're not using his last name to protect his job hunt, recently got laid off as a hotel purchasing manager in New Jersey. But he wasn't that worried, you know, record unemployment and everything. But 3 weeks later,
I can't even get interviews.
Don't complain to Laura Lundale. She got a master's in European politics last September and is still looking for a job at a nonprofit. 282 applications and counting.
Applied a couple weeks ago to a job in the middle of nowhere, Kansas. Trying to be like, well, I like thunderstorms, so that would be fun.
She says it's hard seeing other people get hired.
The internal green-eyed monster is like, I'm happy for you, but what about me?
And today, that you is her boyfriend. They're going out to celebrate his new job tonight. I'm Rima Kreis from Marketplace.
Lest you think global trade, on which we have been spending so much time the past couple of weeks, lest you think it's just an economic story, allow us to introduce you to the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS in the vernacular. There are some congressional hearings due, possibly next week, on legislation that would beef up that committee, which screens would-be foreign investments in this country for national security risks. The balancing act here, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports, is between that protection and businesses that want the investment to help them grow.
CFIUS is not a congressional committee. It's headed by the Treasury Secretary. The members are the heads of government agencies like the Departments of Justice, Commerce, and Defense. It already has a lot of power to stop trade deals in the interest of national security. Now some members of Congress want to give it more.
China has become a global economic powerhouse that will stop at nothing.
That's Congressman Andy Barr, a Kentucky Republican, speaking at a House subcommittee hearing last month. Congress might give CFIUS more oversight, say, of deals that don't involve a complete foreign takeover of a U.S. company. Josh Kalmer with the Information Technology Industry Council also testified at the hearing. He's worried that CFIUS could impede the routine transactions of U.S. companies,
putting them in a position of perpetual uncertainty over whether they are obliged to file with CFIUS simply to go about their daily work.
CFIUS has already stepped up enforcement under the Trump administration. Washington trade lawyer John Cabillo says, yes, CFIUS should be strengthened, but carefully, because he knows of foreign trade deals that fell apart under its microscope.
A couple have been blocked and many more have been abandoned by the parties.
Don Johnson, a former U.S. trade ambassador during the Clinton administration, says Congress shouldn't give CFIUS too much power.
When we start using it purely as a protectionist tool, I think we need to slow down some.
Johnson says if Congress isn't careful, the U.S. will fall behind other countries that don't have such strict trade barriers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
A year ago yesterday, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives voted along party lines to repeal the Affordable Care Act. A celebration at the White House followed, which was itself followed by the Senate not voting to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But while the ACA does officially still stand as part of the new tax law, the individual mandate has gone away, the requirement that people buy health care coverage or pay a fine. And as a result of that, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY, this is going to be another year of premium increases.
Let's start with some good news.
Health insurers are gradually getting better at this.
Deep Banerjee is a healthcare analyst with S&P Global Ratings. The company is an underwriter of our program. Banerjee says insurers have gone from losing their shirts in 2016 to making a modest profit last year.
It is a really good sign to see more insurers be able to make a profit, because that means that less insurers will be inclined to exit the market in the years to come.
But here's the problem. Banerjee thinks most companies won't ever make that much in this market. Think about 2%. With margins like that, health insurers will balk at any uncertainty. The Kaiser Family Foundation's Larry Levitt says by Congress repealing the individual mandate and the Trump administration making it easier to buy non-ACA-compliant plans, insurers have two giant wild cards.
Really what this is about is creating a parallel insurance market with different rules that will be very attractive to healthy people.
Fewer healthy people means even less profit for insurers. In a typical year, the companies will raise premiums to keep up with rising healthcare costs, somewhere around the mid-single digits. But with the threat that healthy people will ditch the market, that's not happening, says Al Bingham with Wakely Consulting.
You know, you're looking at something like mid to high teens.
That's his best guess at a national average. Given insurers' growing comfort with this market, Bingham says if there were less uncertainty this year, he'd expect increases to be about half of what he's expecting. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's just not why you go to a restaurant. It's never at the level of the other food in the place.
The ice cream sundae and why it must be stopped. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1.3% today, 332 points, 24,262. The NASDAQ up 1.7%, 121 points, 7209. S&P 500 picked up about 1.2%, 33 points, ended things at 26.63. For the week gone by, The Dow off 0.2%. The Nasdaq rose 1.25%. The S&P 500 down about 0.2%. Good week it was for Apple, though. The stock jumped another 4% today thanks to Warren Buffett. He disclosed he's been on a 75 million share shopping spree in the first quarter. Buffett shareholders benefited as well. Berkshire Hathaway stock closed up nearly 2% higher. Google, make that alphabet, I guess, clicked up more than 2%. Facebook packed on more than 1% as well. Bonds were steady. Yield on the 10-year Treasury, 2.95%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, it's Kai. You hear me say it all the time. Watch the bond market if you want to understand the economy. Well, you should also watch our YouTube channel for quick video explainers, things you've always wondered about, stories beyond the headlines. Subscribe on YouTube or at Marketplace APM. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. So as we talked about a bit up top, Anna and Sudeep and I, the negotiating team of Mnuchin, Navarro, Lighthizer, and Kudlow is on its way back from Beijing today. The official American readout of the talks, just a bit of which I gave you, was to the point, shall we say. So from Shanghai, Marketplace Jennifer Pack has a sense of how it went over there.
Although the American delegation made some steep demands, including cuts in China's trade surplus with the U.S., Mei Xinyu, a researcher attached to China's Ministry of Commerce, says at least the two sides are talking. In itself, a big step.
Now that the U.S. is agreeing to negotiate, rather than making unilateral demands and asking China to accept them, it shows a change in attitude.
Chinese officials and the state-controlled media have adopted a measured tone over the current trade tensions. And that's why you don't see much anti-American sentiment on the streets of Shanghai. Over the lunch hour, people were packed into KFC and Taco Bell in the shopping district of Nanjing West, where I found Jeremy Tai. He tells me he only uses iPhones.
Considering about technologies, I think American brands are very good.
So American brands mean good stuff?
Yeah.
American firms have been making money in China, but other competitors are increasingly making products that appeal to young people like Joe Su.
American brands are no longer worth the high price. There are many domestic substitutes in China.
U.S. companies complain that some of these Chinese brands get too much help from the government in China, but officials here say they won't open Chinese markets to American firms until China's domestic companies are fully ready. As for the public, many people like Shanghai resident Jennifer Shen believe fears of an all-out trade war are overblown.
It is quite normal that friction and contradiction happen between husband and wife. So the relationship between the U.S. and China is just like a spousal relationship.
And she and many others in China hope for a period of domestic harmony. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Also hoping for a little bit of harmony, this time of the tariff variety. American companies that count on Chinese imports and are more than a little bit worried about the Trump steel and aluminum tariffs.
Well, fingers crossed, but I'm not especially hopeful on it.
That was Pat Cullinan. He filed tariff exemption requests for his company, Great Plains Stainless, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They do stainless steel pipe fittings and the like, some of which do come from China. And it's the same deal for Todd Adams.
We combed the earth, literally. We found one mill that we were confident that they could produce to our specifications and our quality standards. The mill was not in the United States.
Todd, and I'll tell you what, he's not the first one to do this. He said he didn't want us to use his company's name because he's got a pending exemption application.
We've had some conversations with the Commerce Department, and I don't know if they really look at every application the same. It's a little bit political.
A little political, a lot financial. Todd had a shipment from China already on its way here when the tariffs hit, so he had no choice but to pay the tariff.
So we just had to basically loan the government a couple hundred thousand dollars interest free, and we're hoping for a reimbursement.
And how's that going to work?
The Commerce Department doesn't even know that answer. They said we need to follow up with Customs and Border Protection when we have the exemption. So we're going to give it a shot.
Regulations.gov is where you can read some of those exemption requests for yourself. Quick reminder here that we're going to do the international exemption dance again at the end of the month. The European Union, Mexico, and Canada are still crossing their fingers that President Trump is going to see trade things their way. The restaurant industry is crazy competitive, right? Tight margins. There's always the hot new place everybody wants to check out. Finicky diners as well. So restaurants have to look for ways to cut costs wherever and whenever they can, which gets us to dessert. The Humble Ice Cream Sundae specifically, and a recent column by Pete Wells, the food critic at the New York Times, titled, "The Ice Cream Sundae Must Be Stopped." Pete, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I want to be clear here just to save you the hate mail. It's not that you hate ice cream sundaes, right?
No. I like them a lot. I make them for my son's birthday in the summer. I love making hot fudge once a year and then having leftovers that I keep in the refrigerator.
Wait, hot fudge keeps for a year?
Yeah, weirdly. Well, I mean, maybe it's not supposed to. In my house, it does.
All right. But your gripe against the way they're being employed these sundaes in the restaurant environment in New York City is that fundamentally people are getting lazy.
Yeah, I think there are just too many of them being used to cover up a lack of thought or a lack of investment into the dessert course. They've become this thing that you can do that's makes everybody happy because nobody except me will complain about getting ice cream for dessert. But yes,
but you do it in the pages of the New York Times, So
right.
so you have a little bit of oomph. What do you object to really is the pile of ice cream with a bunch of stuff piled on it, right? Without any thought or effort or I guess sophistication and nuance.
My only complaint is about the ones that are just sort of tossed off where the restaurant has bought ice cream from an outside maker and they got someone who's maybe not even a pastry chef to make some granola to throw on it and a couple of pieces of cut up fruit and some quick sauce that they make and they just throw it together and it's fine and it's good enough and like I said, nobody but me is going to complain. But it's just not why you go to a restaurant. It's never at the level of the other food in the place.
I hear you. Let me unpack, though, a little bit of those ingredients, if you will, that you just talked about. First of all, they're cheap to make, right? I mean, the way you describe these failures of ice cream sundaes, right? You get some ice cream, some granola, and boom, you're done, and you're out for, a buck and a half, and you pay $12 at the restaurant.
Yeah, well, I think it's not so much the ingredient cost to the restaurant as the labor cost. When I first got interested in this story, I thought it was a technology story. I thought that restaurants had discovered some great new ice cream maker that they were all using and it was making their lives wonderful. And then when I started calling around, pastry chefs and owners said, no, it's labor. It's labor cost. We can do away with the pastry chef, which is a management level position, pretty high paid, and instead hire somebody for say $40,000 a year as a pastry sous chef, or not even.
But surely you have sympathy for the economics of the restaurant business.
Of course I do. I think there's something a little bit short sighted going on here, though, where restaurants are they're sort of focusing in on each station and asking it to be self sustaining or profitable. I think a well-run bar with a great cocktail menu can make a bunch of money for the restaurant, so nobody's getting rid of that. Yeah. I would say let's subsidize dessert with some of the profits we're making on cocktails.
Pete Wells, food critic for the New York Times. Pete, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out, the Kentucky Derby is this weekend. Technically, for the branding aficionados among you, it's the 2018 Kentucky Derby presented by Woodford Reserve. But that is not the only brand that's going to be on display. One of the favorites at 8-1 odds is a horse named Audible. Amazon, the parent company of the non-horse audio production company called Audible, knows an opportunity when it sees one, so the horse will be wearing Audible branding on Saturday afternoon for the call to the post. Also, and completely randomly, I actually just learned today that Churchill Downs, site of the Derby, is a publicly traded company. Ticker symbol CHDN, doing pretty well, too. Shares up 235% the past 5 years. Hey, look at the time. We got to go. Dow Industrial's up 1.3% today, 332 points. NASDAQ added 1.7%, 121 points there. S&P 500 picked up 1.2%, 33 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.